Subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Water Stories, the untapped way to heal the planet. Thank you to our guest, Zach Weiss, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer, myself, Jack Ike, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Now I'm tired of segregation, and now I want my equal rights. Well, respect and education, well, not total integration. Now that's why I'm fighting for my rights.
I am Don Jacobson, one of the hosts of Moving On Friday from noon to 1:30. This Friday, I'm presenting music of the Civil Rights Movement and related music. From the Montgomery High School Trio to Rhiannon Giddens, we'll hear music that supported and inspired social movement. At a time when the federal government is hacking away at diversity, at KBOO, we are embracing it. Tune in Friday, noon to 1:30, only on KBOO.
Like a tree planted by the world.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is the Progressive Page Turner. I'm Marianne Barisonic. On this program, we'll talk about books with the people who wrote them.
The old order is crumbling. It was under pressure before the Trump regime dismantled large swaths of the social safety net and unabashedly championed the billionaire class. Instability caused by the catastrophically unequal distribution of resources has left wide swaths of society fighting over scraps while the uber wealthy sail above it all. And then there's the structural problem of infinite growth on a finite planet. We need to imagine a different economic system and a new social organization. In his book, The Care Economy, Tim Jackson asks a deceptively simple question. What can it mean for us to live well on a small, blue, finite planet? Tim, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
One meaning of the word care is implicit in healthcare. How does the difference between seeking pleasure and avoiding pain fit into reimagining our economic system?
That's a fascinating question. And it's actually quite a deep question as well, because we tend to think that pain and pleasure are more or less equivalent to the idea of being healthy. But actually, in medical terms, that's not quite right. pain and pleasure are kind of signals that the body receives. Pain when things are going wrong, pleasure when things look like they're going right. Both of them can actually lead us astray, as we know, the unadulterated pursuit of pleasure, which is very close to the heart of our existing vision for the economy in some ways, actually destabilizes the body's own health-preserving mechanisms. It operates through something called the dopamine circuit, and the dopamine circuit works actually in the human body as a balance between pain and pleasure. We balance those things out. If you bombard it with pleasure, strange things happen. You become addicted to the ideas of, you know, let's say food, of drugs, of sex, of pornography, of gambling, of any number of things that destabilize that dopamine balance and lead away from health. So my point is that health, it's not quite the same thing as pain and pleasure. And it very definitely isn't the same thing as wealth. So we tend to think in our modern society that prosperity, how do we live well on a finite planet? Well, we get as rich as possible. We keep increasing our income. The gross domestic product, the GDP, goes on climbing. It's a measure of political success. And as long as that's going up, everything's okay. And of course, that isn't quite true. In fact, it isn't really true at all. It's like the pursuit of pleasure, it turns into a slightly dangerous dynamic where we're continually drawing ourselves towards growth at all costs and forgetting that health actually is mainly about balance. So one of the key propositions in the care economy is just this: let's think about prosperity as health rather than as wealth, and then figure out what that means for our economy. How should our economy behave if that's our North Star, if that's our guide?
And that would mean killing a lot of cultural myths, because a lot of our cultural myths now are that bigger is better, more is good, and it would be very difficult to get people to think about this in a different way, because we're so acculturated to that idea of more, more, more.
Yeah, we are. And that serves some people quite well. I mean, it serves the people who make money off it quite well. It serves the people who profit by weaponizing our own psychology to desire all kinds of stuff which seem to promise to lead to pleasure, but ultimately undermine our health. But I just want to emphasize this one point, that when you shift from prosperity as wealth to prosperity as health, you have a profound change in the dynamic of what society is doing. So if you think about prosperity as wealth, and you said this before, it's all about having more, it's about accumulation, it's about growth. The dynamic is all in one direction, more and more is better and better. But when you think about health, health is very much about balance. It's about not having too much, not having too little. It's about finding and being able to restore ourselves to that point of balance, that point of enough, that point actually where health is possible. Health is entirely, you can define it entirely in terms of this idea of our ability to find that balance. But when you're pursuing prosperity as wealth, you're just going in one direction. So you never see the point of balance. In fact, it's worse than that. You go rushing past it. And even if you noticed it as you were rushing past, you would not be able to stop, because all of the architecture of the modern economy is built around rushing towards more. And as I said, you know, that is of benefit to all the people who can profit from it, but it's undermining our health.
It's interesting that you said it's a benefit to the people who are profiting from it. But if you look at the billionaire class, it's not that these people are terrifically happy. That's the ultimate lie, isn't it? That
we
strive for this continual wealth, but when they get it, it's not like it's made them particularly happy.
No, my heart bleeds for them. I mean, I kind of, yes, of course, it isn't the same thing. And I think you could almost use the same metaphor, that their lives have become unbalanced. You know, they're actually, people who have that much wealth are obsessed with how much wealth they have and are obsessed with becoming more and more wealthy. And that is psychologically unbalancing. So it's not just about physiological health. And if you've got a lot of money, you can certainly protect your physiological health, your physical health, much better than poor people can. The evidence shows that very clearly. But actually, it's quite likely that those people, as you suggest, have some kinds of psychological characteristics which you could not remotely describe as healthy. And that brings us back, in a way, to that idea. Psychological health is also about balance.
The idea that instead of having one metric that, you know, the growth of the economy, that we would have multiple metrics, like how healthy are people, how happy are people thriving, that would be a much more nuanced way of looking at what prosperity means. And it's interesting, in the book you go over one of the indicators of the failure of our current system is workplace protections. You write that, quote, child labor rose by 5% over the years preceding the pandemic and now stands at 160 million children. That's equivalent to one in every 10 kids worldwide. That's staggering. And then you pose this question. If wealth is dependent on child labor and industrial homicide, can we even call it prosperity in the first place? How does our concept of prosperity allow this to happen?
It does it by insisting that prosperity is about wealth. And so as long as the GDP numbers go up, and as you said it yourself, that's our main priority, is to look at those numbers going up and up and up. The economy is expanding and expanding and expanding. So things must be getting better, mustn't they? But when you dig down and you find that you're building that prosperity as wealth on child labor and on people dying in workplace accidents, in poor quality of working conditions, in people who are not paid properly and sometimes not even paid at all, then you can't really think of it as living well. You can't think of it as the population as a whole being better and better off. You can certainly think of it about some people being better off, but you can't really think about that as prosperity. And certainly, if you define prosperity as health, as people being healthy, you can't think about it as prosperity at all. And that's where you're right, that actually we need to be measuring different things. And we also have to accept that that might be a little bit more complicated than when we were just setting our sights on expanding the GDP. Because if you think about just measuring health, actually, that's a complicated procedure. The body measures its own health constantly. It measures the blood sugar level, the calcium level. It measures the amount of food that we're intaking. It determines whether we're hungry or we're full, and it adjusts our behavior according to that. So in other words, it's constantly looking at all of these indicators. We don't even know it's happening. You know, this is happening in our autonomic nervous system without any realization, any conscious realization ourselves of what's going on. And we are being regulated around all these balances that determine health within the physical body. So it's a more complicated process.
There's a lot of history in the book about how health care became gendered and what the implications for society are rolled up in that.
Yeah, exactly. What we see as healthcare today is something which we've arrived at historically. And in the process of arriving at it historically, we've made certain key decisions about what counts in the system and what doesn't count in the system. So for example, sale of pharmaceutical drugs, prescription drugs. That is an incredibly important thing within our healthcare system. And it's often valued. It's valued through the profits that companies who create pharmaceutical drugs can assume that they will achieve within the healthcare market. But the nitty-gritty process of looking after people when they're sick, of looking after young people, of looking after elderly people, of paying attention to the needs and the demands of people when they're unwell, physically and psychologically unwell, that process, which I would describe broadly as the process of care, is a kind of second or third class citizen in our healthcare system. It takes time, time is money in the system, so we try and reduce the input of care as much as possible, and yet it is the one thing that sets up the conditions which allow our bodies to recover, which allow health to happen. So care, to me, and the denigration, the neglect of care in the existing system, in the existing economy, sits right at the heart of the problem. And it's exactly what we need to get back to, because at the end of the day, actually, if you don't have care, if you don't look after young people, if you don't allow them the conditions in which they can grow up and be useful members of society, you don't have a workforce, you don't have an economy, you don't have any growth, you don't have any output, you don't have any profit whatsoever. Care is to some extent, is the essence of our civilization. It's the essence of the way in which an organism maintains health by constant attention to these balances. And it has to be, therefore, a design condition for how we think about the economy. And if we neglect it, we neglect it at our peril.
It was historically women who were responsible for care. And then men came in and kind of took over and started to focus on the drugs and the surgery and that sort of thing. There were women healers. Were they not effective?
It's really fascinating and slightly frightening when you look at it, because it happened at a very specific point in time where, as you say, lay healing was a very common, very well integrated social phenomenon, and it was largely in the hands of women. And then there was a point in the early 20th century, and it was precipitated by a specific report by a man called Abraham Flexner in the United States. And he wrote a report which was about the conditions of medicine and health in the US and Canada. And it was enormously influential. And basically what he says is, we've got to professionalize this. There's too many people wandering around saying that they're healers or doctors. His incentive to do that was good. It was, let's not have quacks who are selling miracle cures, which actually don't make people better. Let's try and get some conditions of what the discipline should look like. But he kind of went overboard and insisted basically that a certain ideal of modern lab-based medicine is the only basis for a professional healthcare system. And in the wake of the Flexner report, actually, lay healing became more or less ostracized. Naturopathy, which has a long pedigree dating all the way back to Hippocrates and the ancient Greeks, that was ostracized as well. It became persona non grata in the medical system. In its place, we were given over to a healthcare system which was predominantly around finding pharmaceutical solutions to illnesses that were defined by germs that could be isolated in the laboratory and then killed with the right drugs. Not to say that that is wrong in itself, but what's wrong is that you build your entire healthcare system around that. And in fact, what's most interesting about that history is that it was driven, the Flexner report and the follow-up to it was funded by the Carnegie and the Rockefeller foundations. And it was funded at a time when what those foundations, what those families were doing, I should say, because the foundations were supporting what the Carnegie and Rockefeller families had made their wealth out of, which was to have markets for products that could be sold at a profit. And the new domain of profit was pharmaceutical drugs. And so it suited capitalism, if you like. It suited that early 20th century capitalism that was beginning to find more and more profit in more and more markets. But it totally distorted our vision of what healthcare is, of what it had been before, and what it could be in the future. And we're still living with the legacy of that.
You're listening to The Progressive Page Turner on KBOO, your member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station. I'm Marianne Barasonic. My guest is Tim Jackson, and we're talking about his book, The Care Economy. There needs to be a balance between that kind of health care and the kind of care where you're sitting with someone who's dying and holding their hand, or being by the side of a mother who's giving birth. And that's the kind of care that no matter what AI does, you need a human for this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we can't solve the problems that we're looking at the moment with pharmaceuticals, because they're not really infectious diseases that you can bang on the head with a drug. Okay, occasionally something like COVID comes along, you can create a vaccine, very good, absolutely a victory for pharmaceutical intervention. But actually a lot of the diseases that we're looking at are diseases which affect what's sometimes been called the terrain of health, the conditions under which the body is trying to maintain its own health. And they manifest themselves not as infectious diseases, but as chronic non-communicable diseases like diabetes and asthma and heart disease and musculoskeletal diseases and mental health conditions. These are not things you can bang on the head with a drug. We do our best to sort of improve conditions for people who are suffering from these sorts of illnesses. But the root cause of those illnesses is not some nasty germ somewhere that you can isolate in a lab and get rid of. It's actually the conditions under which we're living. And a part of those conditions, of course, is the enormous changes in our diet, the enormous changes in our food system, the enormous changes in the way that we work, which has created stresses which we're not well adapted for. So all of these conditions, this health terrain, is absolutely critical in understanding what's called the burden of disease in the 21st century. And that burden of disease is dominated by chronic conditions. It's now killing more than 70% of all deaths worldwide are associated with these chronic conditions, non-communicable diseases rather than infectious illnesses. We have to change our way of dealing with this. And we have to recognize that actually care, that attention to the conditions of our lives, is an integral part of that process.
What's meant by the term sacred canopy?
It was a term that was coined by a sociologist called Peter Berger. And in his book, The Sacred Canopy, he talked about how religion operates as a sacred canopy. It makes sense of our lives. If you have religious beliefs, then you can guide your life. You can think about meaning and purpose in your life. It might involve your good behavior, which results in you going to heaven rather than hell, or it might be some different kind of religious belief about the rewards that are associated with you when you are a good person. But these beliefs, although they developed, although they're most obviously described as the sacred canopy when it comes to religion, because religion presents us with the idea of sacredness, what Peter Berger points out is that every society has to have this framework, this structure. We have to be able to understand what's going on in society. We have to be able to make sense of suffering and loss. We have to be able to legitimize our political structures in the face of this suffering and loss. Because if we don't have these things, then trust is eroded, our sense of purpose is eroded. We have an increased sense of anxiety. We don't know what's going on. We can't make sense of any of it. So the sacred canopy, as an idea, is a sort of social phenomena, social necessity to have something that holds our lives together and makes sense of it. And the point that I make in the book is that, in a sense, when religion began to decline in importance, particularly in the West, we kind of replaced that sacred canopy with a semi-religious belief in consumerism, in the power of material things to infinitely improve our lives. And of course, in economic growth as the thing that drives that process. So that prosperity as wealth is our kind of sacred canopy at the moment. It's the one that has guided our lives, particularly in the post-war years. It's the one that's helped us to replace the God-shaped hole that was left when religion became less important, particularly in the secular West. It's a way of bringing us back to a really central question. The absence of health and the denigration of care really report right back to our fundamental vision of what society is, where it's going, what is its North Star, where is it headed, and how can we replace this empty, hopeless view of a future in which we can't make sense of our lives and all of our meaning is lost and the only thing left is profit and wealth for those who can achieve it. How can we get beyond that to a different kind of sacred canopy, a different way of creating meaning and purpose in the world?
You make the distinction in the book between physical health and symbolic health. What do you mean by symbolic health?
Yeah, this is similar to the distinction I was making earlier on between physical health, if you like, and psychological health, our mental well-being. It's quite a tricky one because it's clear that you can't just orient society around physiological health. You can't just insist on vital signs and the plethora of medical information that we have about the balances in our body being the sole determinant of our sense of well-being, our broader prosperity. Because actually, lots of things determine how well we are. And some of those things are social and psychological. They're not material at all. They're not physiological at all. And we know, for example, that people who suffer from mental ill health are much more likely also to suffer from physical ill health. We know that mental well-being is one of the biggest remedies that we have for physical illnesses. So in other words, this element of symbolic health, this psychological health, I am not just a material being. I am someone with a life that involves meaning and purpose, my relationships with other people, this symbolic health that really matters to me alongside my physical health. And we have to acknowledge that that is central to a different kind of view of the economy. We actually have to apply similar principles of care to that symbolic economy that we do to the physiological or the physical economy that's associated with our material health.
You get into the idea of degrowth in the book. How would you define this? And do you think this is a viable option for the future?
It's a difficult thing for people to comprehend because it seems to be saying it's kind of the opposite of growth. You know, let's not have a golden target for the GDP that goes up and up and up. Let's instead turn the GDP knob down so that we get less and less growth. And this is a difficult thing to comprehend for people, partly because less growth has been associated with worse social outcomes in recent history. We call it a depression or a recession. And we try to avoid it as much as possible. But the way that I tend to think about the problem is that we shouldn't fixate on degrowth, but we should think in terms of a post-growth society. So where we're not fixated either on GDP going up or on GDP going down. We're not intent on controlling the speed of the economy. We're intent on measuring the things that matter and putting in place policies to ensure that they happen. And whatever happens to the GDP in that process is kind of irrelevant as long as we have our indicators right, as long as we have our directions of travel right, as long as we're taking care of physical health, as long as we're taking care of symbolic health. And I think of this not so much in the language of degrowth, but the language of post-growth. The society which is no longer obsessed with growth and is no longer obsessed with that indicator of the GDP. It's looking where we can reasonably measure all kinds of aspects of our prosperity and where we can make the right choices in pursuit of our own health.
How optimistic are you that we'll be able to change our thinking about prosperity in time to avoid ecological and cultural collapse?
I think optimism is a bit of a luxury. If we spend too much time thinking about what creates optimism or what creates hope or how we achieve hope, it seems like it'd be a nice thing to have, but it's not absolutely essential. What is essential, it seems to me, is the ability to work towards the things that matter, to be able to identify for ourselves what is our North Star, what does really matter in life. What are the things that when we get to our deathbed, we look back and we say, that mattered to me, this mattered to me. My pursuit of a higher income than my next door neighbor or the wealth that I can accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, that may have been instrumental in some bits of my life, but that's not my North Star. My optimism, if I were to be forced into adopting a definitive optimism, it rests in ultimately in people's ability to see that, to think in terms of the things that matter in our lives and to be able to distinguish between the things that matter and the things that glitter. One of the things I'm trying to do in the book and in my work generally is to give people the resources to do that for themselves, to not have to be the hostages to a broken system, which is as I said before, kind of weaponizing our own psychological health in order to achieve profits for a few people. Prosperity is something in which we all have a birthright, and it's something in which we really need to take the responsibility for ourselves in thinking about the changes that are needed, not just in our own lives, but in society as a whole, and working towards those changes. I think that's where optimism comes from. The ultimate end game of an economic system based around growth is conflict for resources, violence, and warfare. And we are in danger of moving into such a world. 80 years after the end of the Second World War, we're being encouraged almost into a mindset which is driving us towards a frightening level of potential violence and ultimately potentially of war. And we are doing it in conditions which are very, very different from those that pertained in 1945. We actually have more than enough military armaments to destroy the world several times over. And a war that called in those resources would make all of our questions trivial and probably be the end of most of human society. So there is so much at stake in relation to that, that we have to, I think, work wherever we can to shift that balance of power, to argue and to articulate a form of power which is embedded in simple principles of health as a process of balance and care as a restorative force that brings us back into balance.
You've been listening to The Progressive Page Turner. My guest has been Tim Jackson, and we've been talking about his book, The Care Economy. Tim, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
We all listen. We're in the Fireside Theater. We all listen to this fabulous station in Portland, and it's called
It's a Lorenzo Milam original. It's one of his. It's one of his spawn. And we'd like to say hello to all the people at KBOO, and then thanks for that coffee cake that that volunteer made 2 days ago.
Yeah, it's still coming down, man.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio